and welcome to another edition of Science Spinning, the show with an Irish spin on science with me, Sean Duke, here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. The potato has, we all know, played a crucial role in the often tragic history of Ireland. At the time of the Great Famine between 1845 and 51, the cause of the potato blight was the subject of mere speculation. No one really knew what was causing the blight or how it could be stopped. These days we know a lot more about the potato, and it was recently announced that an international team had sequenced the potato's entire genome or genetic code. Why should we care about the potato genome? Well, shortly I'll put that question to Dan Milburn. He's a Carlow-based researcher at Ireland's agricultural research agency, Chagosc, who is part of the multi-nation potato DNA research team. Marie Curie, the French woman who discovered the elements radium and polonium and won two Nobel Prizes, must surely be ranked as one of the greatest scientists ever. And she was also the first woman to win a Nobel Prize back in 1903. In the second half of the show, I'll be talking to her granddaughter, Professor Hélène Langevin-Joly, who's Professor of Physics at University of Paris, who's giving a talk on her illustrious grandmother in TCD tomorrow, Friday. The talk is entitled Marie Curie Beyond the Myth, and it's been given to mark 300 years of chemistry studies at Trinity College in Dublin. But first up, we're going to be talking about the potato and its genome with Dan Milburn, researcher with Chagosc. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thanks, Sean. How are you doing?
Congratulations on the paper in Nature. Nature, of course, is a prestigious journal, but it's taken a long time to get to this point.
Yeah, we've been doing it for a few years now, so it's good to see something coming with it last.
Okay. Now, tell us why, I suppose the first question in people's minds is, why would we want to sequence or get the entire genetic information from a potato? Why would we bother doing that?
Yeah, well, let's look at the bigger picture and answer it that way. The world population is currently 6.5 billion, and it's going to be 9.1 billion by 2050. And the FAO thinks we need to probably double world food production by that time to cover the difference.
Mm-hmm.
Blight, which you just referred to, it killed you know, millions of people in the mid 1800s. Even now, despite the fact that, as you say, we know a lot more about these things, it still costs worldwide 5 billion euro in a mixture of control measures and crop losses. So these are some of the problems we're facing in terms of food production at the moment.
It might be a surprise to people that blight is still such a big issue, you know, 150 years plus after the Great Famine, but it is, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you've got to remember that, as the crop evolves, so do its diseases, and so it's basically an arms race, a constant arms race. And I guess it used to be just between the plant and the pathogen, and now, of course, we're involved, I guess, on the side of the plant. So what we're trying to do is weigh in there on the side of the plant and give it the advantage.
Do you know, it might be an unfair question, kind of putting you on the spot, but how many other plants have been sequenced, or animals even at this stage, you know, their entire genome?
You are putting me on the spot purely because it's such a it's happening so fast now with these new sequencing technologies. I tell you what, there exists very, very good, what we call complete sequences for at least two species, which are rice and a model plant species, which is basically a weed that you'd find in your garden called Arabidopsis. And those two sequences are at the same level of as the human genome in terms of their quality and their finishing. And a lot of the other genome sequences, including this one of potato, are what we call draft sequences, which means that you've got, you know, probably 80 to 90% of the genome sequence, and there's that 10% which is made up of very, very difficult to sequence DNA, and we don't quite have that yet.
Okay. Now, Chagosc's main interest then in taking part in this project originally, I guess, was to breed better potato varieties, wasn't it?
Yes, definitely.
So how is it going to help with that? Or maybe tell us a little bit. I know it's not exactly your area, but how do you breed potatoes?
Yeah, okay, that's the best way of explaining it, actually, because the way we breed potatoes, and we've been doing this Chagosc for the last 40 years, and we've got 36 varieties, of which you'll only have heard of a few, probably. And potato breeding, it might surprise people to know that the timescale for potato breeding is incredibly long. So from the first cross you make between two individual potatoes to the release of a new variety takes about between 10 and 15 years.
Yes.
And what you're trying to do basically is, if you've got two potatoes and one's blight resistant and but the other is very good yielding, what you want to get out of the other side of that process is a blight resistant high yielding potato. So you cross these two individuals, you'll get seeds from that cross, kind of similar to the way if you split open a tomato, berry, you'll see seeds inside there. Potatoes produce very, very similar berries to tomatoes, but don't eat them. They're very, very poisonous. And what we do then is to spend the next 10 or 15 years selecting from these sorts of crosses the best potato we can that combines all of the traits. I've only mentioned two, which are yield and blight resistance, but we actually select for about 50 traits. And
right.
The fact that we have to select for these 50 traits, which takes the time, because we can't select for all of these traits at once.
Sure, and of course, breeding is an art in anything in any plant, with plants or animals. But if you have this genetic, the genome, then it can speed this process up.
Yes, definitely. What we do at the moment, for instance, for disease resistance, because it's a testing for it is a destructive process. So if I've got a potato plant and I'm interested to see whether it's resistant to blight, the way I do that is I have to infect it with blight, and if it destroys the plant, it's susceptible. And even if it's resistant, if it's vaguely resistant, it'll still do fairly serious damage to the plant. And then there's a potential I lose that plant for my breeding program very, very early on. And it might be good for other things as well. What we're doing at the moment at Chagas is to take, instead of actually directly screening for resistances, in many cases, we're taking a very, very small fingernail-sized bit of leaf material from the plants and subjecting them to a genetic fingerprinting analysis, which we've developed based on the information from the genome sequence. And using these genetic fingerprinting techniques, we're tracking instead of the characteristic, we're actually tracking the gene that's causing the characteristic.
Okay, you're following the gene, whereas the traditional way, it's on site what you're looking at.
You're following the what we call the phenotype, which is what the gene causes.
What it looks like
in the plant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So be able to actually track the gene instead of the phenotype allows us to do this whole process of selection for many of these traits very, very much earlier on in the process.
Okay. Now, a couple of the success stories from Chagas, potato-wise, the rooster. Everybody will be familiar with the rooster. Maybe tell us about that. I mean, it's a very competitive area, of course. Lots of different potato varieties, this is one of the big ones.
Yeah, the problem with potato breeding is unlike... I mean, if you ate your Weetabix this morning, and you have no idea what wheat variety went into that, and in fact, it's probably not the same wheat variety every time. The trouble with potatoes is there is a very good brand recognition by people. People mm-hmm. know these things, so there's rooster and there's other ones as well.
Yeah.
And when you're breeding potatoes, you're actually competing against other brands as such, which are other potato varieties. It's quite difficult to knock people's favourites off the market. So rooster is largely was bred as a replacement for Kerr's Pink, which is another favourite variety. But Kerr's Pink was bred at the beginning of the 20th century. I think it's 1912 it was originally released. So it's very, very difficult to compete against these things. And so a new potato variety has actually got to have a lot going for it to be successful.
Okay, but there's still efforts going on, obviously, to develop new varieties.
Oh, we never stop, because, you know, the things like blight are a constantly moving target. And there are also markets. The markets change. And so, for instance, in the past in Ireland, the primary use of potatoes was, you know, it's what we call the ware market, so for table consumption, your dinner, basically. And what's happening more and more is that, of course, the potato is becoming an important constituent in processed foods, and the processing industry has very, very exacting requirements as to what it wants from a potato. And again, the genome sequence will allow us to speed up our ability to select for the specific traits that we're interested for processing as well.
Okay, so just to get back to the big picture then, you know, you were talking about how the world's population is growing. If we manage to sequence lots of different plant varieties, then that's going to help us, isn't it, with a strategy for feeding the world?
Yeah, I mean, I guess people maybe don't quite appreciate the contribution that, plant breeding has had already in terms of the entire development of human culture. And it's been a constant activity, and it's actually pretty much what's driven human culture. It's what allowed people to settle down and stop moving about as hunter-gatherers in the first place.
Sure, yeah.
And, you know, populations continuing to expand, and the most effective way, one of the most effective ways of keeping up with population expansion is to try and increase the yields of plants and to be able to produce plants, to be able to produce crops, at a greater level on the same amount of land that we currently have. Because at the same time as population expansion, of course, we've got other challenges like global warming and things like that that we have to take into account as well.
And with the tracking of the genes and then moving them around a bit, I guess, that's not the same, is it, or is it, as genetic, you know, this GM thing you hear about, genetic modification?
No, so genetic modification is a distinct process where you effectively scoop a gene out of something and you put it into something else. So it's a process. Insights into the biology of the potato that we are afforded by the genome sequence will certainly, in the future, this will start a developmental process which will, I think, probably allow very elegant approaches to solving some of our problems with genetic engineering. But it's not something that we're doing at Chagask at the moment in terms of releasing potato varieties.
Okay, now this project, it was quite a long one, so have you come to the end of it now, or what's next?
Oh no, I mean, there's that saying, it's just the beginning really, because now the really interesting biology starts, and I think all of the partners, and there's 100 authors on this paper, all of these people will go away back to their own labs, and they will have their own objectives, and they'll be using the genome, and we'll all be using the genome sequence to further our own research goals. And of course, during the process, we've made a lot of good friends and a lot of collaborators as well. So it's exciting, you know. We see the genome sequence as well as an endpoint, because it's been a long time coming. It's also a starting point for a lot of other stuff.
Right, but it won't mean the end of blight, will it? Because, as you say, like, blight changes, so you know, obviously you have to respond to that.
Yeah, unfortunately, it won't mean the end of blight. But it will make our ability to respond to blight very, very much greater.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Dan, for coming on the show and telling us all about that project. It's a multi-nation project that was looking at the potato genome sequence. That's been achieved just now after several years of work, and it was published in the international journal Nature just recently. Thanks, Dan.
Cheers, bye.
Okay. Now, in news this week, just an item that caught my attention just while we queue up our next guest. It concerns antidepressants. This was in Scientific American. Antidepressants, are they just placebos with side effects? Well, there's a major argument going on in medicine about whether antidepressants which don't work in people, are they simply a placebo? And a placebo means something that you would give to somebody and they think it's a medicine, but it actually isn't a medicine. So, for example, it could be a pill that people might think is a medicine, but it might be just a tablet that has no effect whatsoever. Now, there's a debate going on right across the medical world between those who would defend the use of antidepressants, that they work quite well and they're on a par with other medications that doctors would prescribe. But a lot of other doctors, including people in Harvard and very prestigious universities, they actually believe that they may just be another form of placebo. So if this actually is true, it means that the whole basis for psychiatry may be open to question. And certainly this would be something of concern to a lot of people. Now, it doesn't mean that people should stop taking their medicine immediately, but maybe there's more to it, why some people actually respond to the drugs and why some people don't. So I just thought that was an interesting one there this week. Now, next up, I'm looking forward now to talking to Marie Curie's granddaughter. Marie Curie, of course, was the famous scientist who won the Nobel Prize in 1903, was the first woman to win a Nobel Prize for physics in 1903. She actually won another Nobel Prize in 1911, this time for chemistry. She discovered She discovered radium and polonium and was a major figure in the whole discovery about radioactivity and what we now know about it. And her granddaughter, Professor Helene Langevin-Joly, who's in Dublin at the moment, she's going to be giving a talk on her grandmother tomorrow in Trinity College, and she's on the line now. Hello, welcome to the programme.
I will speak about my grandmother, Marie Curie, but I will speak also slightly about Pierre Curie.
Sure, no problem at all.
Because the first discovery was by Pierre Curie and Marie Curie, the two, a team of scientists, and for the first time, a woman and a man.
Yeah. Maybe you could tell listeners what it was like for scientists back when your grandmother was working as a scientist. It was very male-dominated, wasn't it?
Sure. The situation was a male-dominated society. But it was already a time where the status, the inferior status of women, start to be discussed more or less. So she benefited, in a sense, of this situation. This was not the same thing as maybe in the middle of the 19th century.
Sure.
Hopefully.
Yeah, sure. And do you remember your grandmother yourself?
Very slightly. I have mostly souvenir through what has been explained to me about photographs and films and many things from the family, you know. So I mixed my own souvenir with the souvenir from the family.
Sure, sure. She seems, just from my reading now, I read a book recently about her, she seems to be a very determined woman.
She was a woman, certainly she loved so much science that she spent a very large part of her life in the laboratory, but I think important to show to people that she was not always at the laboratory. She has also a private life, a family life, and in the second part of her life, after Pierre Curie's death, this was a terrible break in her life. The life with her two girls,
Irene and Eve,
very, very tight, and for that, I think this is important to show, because otherwise people think Marie Curie was always alone. Hopefully she was not always alone, in spite of the fact that her life has been a tragedy.
Yes, yes, and we don't often talk about scientists, their private lives, and the fact that they're, you know, the same as everybody else. They have families and other lives.
Exactly, and if you are reading, for example, the letters between Marie and my mother, Irene, and my aunt, Eve, the two girls of Marie, those letters, you find the same kind of things that you may find in another family letter on those times. I think it's important to show that Marie was also that woman, and not only a pure scientist working alone and against everybody.
Yeah, sure, sure, I know what you mean. Yeah. So she was from Poland originally, and she came to France then. So how did she link up with Pierre? How did that happen?
She loved Poland, that's true. But she really became a French scientist. And even after Pierre Curie's death, and even after some problems that occurred in France in the year 1911, she chose to remain in France. And she brought up her girls as young French girls, with the French use all that. She don't wish that her girls was shared between two countries. She deliberately chose one country.
Yes.
This one.
Yes. Now, just moving on to, I know you wanted to talk about the discovery of radium and polonium. Polonium became famous recently because of the death of the man in London. Who's, but but anyway, going back to its discovery, we didn't know much about radioactivity at that time at all. This is going back 1903. The prize was awarded in physics.
In fact, polonium was discovered in July 1898.
Okay.
In July. In fact, it was the first discovery. Radium was 6 months later. Maybe. Mm. If they already knew that there was a second element, but they cannot anticipate that the second element would be more important than polonium in the year after, because radium has been very important for physicists, for chemists, and also for physicians, because of the first treatment with gamma rays from radium.
Yes, yes. And in terms of radiation then, I mean, radiation isn't something that you can see, it's not something that you can smell, so did we know before Marie Curie, did we know it existed at all?
You know nothing about radioactivity. The term radioactivity was coined by Marie Curie herself.
Okay.
To describe the activity of polonium and radium, which was 100 million times more important than the radiation by uranium, which has been discovered by Henri Becquerel. So, in fact, the new field, or research field, which is radioactivity in the beginning of the 20th century, start really after the discovery of radium and polonium. And everywhere in laboratory, physicists and chemists start to study, to try to understand what was radioactivity, to discover new radio elements and so on.
Mm-hmm. And with radioactivity, I think a lot of people might have a negative idea because of, say, Chernobyl or, you know, what's happened, different accidents. But what would be the positive side of radioactivity for mankind?
For mankind, radioactivity, for example,
how can
to
we
start
use it?
With, it's a quite natural phenomena. It is able to explain that Earth is get its warmth at the interior, inside the Earth. You have radioactive elements, and they contribute for the major part to the heat inside Earth. Without radioactivity, it would be completely cold for long.
Right, so we wouldn't survive without it.
So, in fact, after radioactivity was discovered, physicists were forced to agree with geophysicists and even also Will Darwin to understand that Earth was a very old... very old, much older than physicists were thinking before.
And
billion years.
Sure, yeah. And they use the... It's like a little radioactive cell in the center of the Earth, then, is it kind of keeping us warm?
During at war, it's the same that most important discovery that can be used for useful things and they can be used for very dangerous things. So radioactivity, the radiation can be used to cure some disease, especially cancer, at the time you have no modern apparatus to get enough radiation.
Yes,
okay.
You can target a cancer.
So it was used together with X-rays, but they were more powerful at that time. But later, all the trend of science, of the science of radioactivity, turned also to nuclear physics. And with nuclear physics, artificial radioactivity occur. And in these times, this gave the possibility to use tracer method to start to understand biological biological processes. So you may say that the progress of modern biology is start with the fact you are able to have the to use X-ray to understand the skeleton, to how protein are built and so on.
Yes.
And you are able with radioactive tracer to understand how the reaction are produced in the human people. And you may understand that, okay, you change, you have not inside of you, each of us, the cells are changing at the rates that you can measure through radioactivity in all time. Now you have other processes, other methods.
If they want to see something, if there's a problem, they can put a radioactive tracer and maybe check if your gut or whatever is okay, because then it will show up on a scan.
So the consequences have been very important. After that, it's true that this fission of the nucleus of uranium was discovered, and it can be used to produce energy, and it has been used to produce bombs.
Sure.
That's a problem.
Now, quite amazingly, she won a second Nobel Prize, 1911. So extraordinary that she won two. Not many people, I'd say, have done that.
The second prize is more or less linked with the first one. At the time of the first one, it was a prize for physics. And in fact, the discovery by Pierre and Marie Curie was the discovery of trace element in ordinary element. You have a very, very small amount, for example, of radium in a salt of barium. But for chemists, what was important was to be able to have a pure element so that you can measure the atomic mass and place that element in the schedule of other elements. And this was very important to understand what happens, what means radioactivity. In fact, it was not the Curie, but Rutherford and Soddy would prove that radioactivity is a transformation of one chemical element into another one with emission of radiation. All that was very, very important.
Okay. And you yourself, I should say, you, if I haven't said so already, you of course are a professor of physics in Paris. So were you inspired by Marie Curie, your grandmother, to become a scientist?
I am not sure I was inspired, but I was brought up in a family where research was something very important. And I would say especially that research looks at something very interesting for a young girl.
Yeah, so it's...
So that was the reason. I have chosen nuclear physics because maybe it was in the air of the time.
Yeah. Or maybe
today I would have chosen something else. Or maybe another something completely different.
Well, thank you very much for taking time out to talk to me. I know you're talking in Trinity tomorrow on your grandmother, Marie Curie, Beyond the Myth. And thanks for coming on and sharing your thoughts on your grandmother with us here today on 103.2 Dublin City FM.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we've run out of time for this week, folks, but if you're interested in finding out more about what's happening in the world of science at home or around the world, then why not check out my blog, also called Science Spinning, at seanduke.com. There you can find previous podcasts of this show. You can also find a lot of feature material there, a lot of news items too, so seanduke.com. And also, if you'd like to contact me here on the show, my email is sciencespinning@dublincityfm.ie. I'd love to get feedback from you. If you have any suggestions or news items that you'd like to share, that email again is sciencespinning@dublincityfm.ie. So until next week at 3:30 on Thursday, it's bye-bye from me, Sean Duke, here on 103.2 Dublin City FM.
news for Dublin people. Dublin City FM.